Welcome to the public event on tightening the purse strings but countering terrorism financing costs, gender equality and security. Please turn off your phones before... you're forgiven, you're at WPS, so it's fine, you're from our centre. I'm Zeynep Kaya, I'm a researcher at the Centre for Women, Peace and Security. I also work at the LSE Middle East Centre. And I'm delighted to be here to be chairing this event. This event, this public event, is hosted by the Center for Women, Peace and Security, and we are delighted to have Jane and Isabel will be talking about their report, which has the same title as the event. The report was published by Duke Law and the Women Peacemakers Program, and Isabel and Jane will be talking about their research findings. We have a discussant, Zarina from GAPS, who will be responding to Isabel's and Jane's presentation. As I said, just some practicalities. Please silence your phones. And if you would like to comment on the event, you're very welcome to use Twitter and other social media by using the hashtag LSEGenderPVE. The presentations discussions and question and answers will be recorded and will be available via podcast through the LSE Center for Women, Peace and Security's website. But if you have something to say and if you don't want to be in the podcast, please say so before you make your comment or ask your question. So just briefly, I will introduce you to the speakers, and without taking too much time, we will move on to their talk. Jane is clinical professor of law and director of the International Human Rights Clinic at Duke University School of Law. She has recently served as an expert advisor to the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights on Gender and Human Rights and Countering Terrorism and Violent Extremism. She was the researcher and writer on gender, counter-terrorism and violent extremism for the UN Global Study on the Implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 1325. And in 2014, she was the expert advisor to the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe and the Global Counter-Terrorism Forum Initiative on Women and Countering Violent Extremism and Radicalization that Leads to Terrorism. She's also editor with Margaret Satterwhite of Gender, National Security and Counterterrorism Human Rights Perspectives. Thank you for coming, Jane. And Isabel is executive director of Women Peacemakers Program. Isabel's peace activism started during her studies when she lived in Belfast and conducted research about local communities' experience of the Troubles, the Good Friday Agreement, and the impact of peace projects run by local community leaders. In 2002, she became the program manager of the Women Peacemakers Program at IFOR, which provided support to women peace activists worldwide through capacity building on gender-sensitive active nonviolence, WPS advocacy, and research and documentation. Under her leadership, Women Peacemakers Program started pioneering a program on engaging men for gender-sensitive peacebuilding. Since the organization's establishment as independent foundation during October 2012, Isabel serves as the executive director. She also serves on the steering committee of the Feminist Alliance for Rights, the advisory board of the 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence campaign, and the advisory board of Women Cross DMZ. Very impressive bios. Thank you, Isabel, for being here. And Zarina is currently director of GAPS Gender Action for Peace and Security. She joined GAPS as director in February 2017 and has previously served on the GAPS Management Committee and chaired GAPS Policy Working Group. Zarina came to GAPS from the International Rescue Committee UK, where she was the Women's Protection and Empowerment Policy Advisor, leading policy and advocacy on women and girls' protection from gender-based violence in humanitarian settings. She previously held position at Safer World, Womankind Worldwide, and Amnesty International, working on gender, peace and security, women's rights and development, women's participation in peace building, and violence against women and girls. Zarina has also trained in working with survivors of sexual violence for voluntary work in the UK. Very impressive as well. And so without further ado, let's move on to the discussion. Our speakers will have about 15 minutes to talk, and then Zarina will offer her comments, and then we will open the floor to your questions and comments.
Thank you, Zeynep, for that very kind and thorough introduction, and thank you to the LSE Centre for Women, Peace and Security for hosting this event tonight and to give a chance to present the findings of the joint report of the Duke University International Human Rights Clinic and Women Peacemakers Programme entitled Tightening the Purse Strings, What Countering Terrorism Financing Costs Gender Equality and Security. Before I sort of get into the very detailed findings and methodology of our report, and Isabel will also continue that discussion, you know, the overall report is really analysing how countering terrorism financing rules, these are rules designed to stem terrorism financing flows that are encapsulated, for example, through criminalisation, through sanctions and asset freezing, through de-risking by financial institutions, and through donor counter-terrorism contract clauses, how that these rules, even though they're notionally gender neutral on their face, actually end up having particular adverse impacts on women's rights organising, women's rights organisations, and gender equality. And particularly, and you know, the reason why we began the report was there has been some work that had begun to be done, and really looking at how these rules were impacting on civil society writ large, but there had been a tendency to treat the impacts and to treat civil society as a homogenous entity, like to not really think about were these rules and their impacts being experienced differently by different types of organisations working in different types of areas. And particularly, we wanted to really anchor that in an international human rights law analysis to really think about when these effects were being experienced, did they actually implicate legal obligations rather than being mere inconveniences that flowed from government decision-making and the implementation of these rules by banks. So this is a new area of research, and to sort of get to really identifying these impacts in a way that would be meaningful and evidence-based for decision-makers, we implemented sort of a multi-faceted approach to the research. In particular, a core component was a survey conducted by WPP of grassroots women's organisations, primarily working in at-risk areas or sort of post-conflict areas, asking them, you know, are you experiencing impacts in your financial services from your donors by virtue of these rules? And what do those impacts look like? And how are you adapting? And we'll go through what those impacts look like. We then undertook analysis and data visualization of those survey results to really think about what trends were being revealed and also the prevalence of those patterns. At Duke, my students and I and my colleague, Sarah Domchak, conducted interviews with 53 different types of organizations or agencies. And here we really went to both at the government level, particularly a number of governments that are very influential in setting the agenda on counterterrorism financing. We also spent a lot of time talking to intergovernmental entities, so UN level and so forth, particularly security folks working in those entities in charge of implementing and evaluating these rules. We also spoke to international financial institutions. Okay, again, these are groups that are involved in evaluating these rules. Large NGOs, we spent a lot of time talking to donors, in particular women's funders groups, asking them, do these rules that are designed to cut off money to terrorism financing, have they changed like how you give, where you give, and to whom you give? And the answer was yes, yes, and yes, and we'll sort of go through that, but to really kind of round out the picture of information. And then we spoke to financial institutions, so banks who are implementing these rules, and academics. And then you know, there were a number of limitations in designing this work and the information, but you know, there was an incredible amount of sensitivity and need for assurance of confidentiality, so all of the interviews were off the record, and the survey data was itself anonymized as well, and that was critical to enabling the breadth of information that we're able to present. Okay. It's a very brief pictorial presentation that WPP surveyed 60 women's organisations working in more than 60 countries worldwide. That was a very important component of the survey because very often when we began talking to governments and talking to intergovernmental institutions and to banks about the impact of these rules, there's a sense that perhaps these impacts might be limited to Syria, or to Somalia, or potentially to Iraq, where there have been concerns about terrorism financing flows. And really what we wanted to look at were the trends that were being revealed going to be more global in nature. Okay, so overall finding is that as a result of these rules, that women's rights organisations have, number one, lost access to critical resources. They're no longer getting the funding they need. And secondly, the ability to fully use banking facilities. And the result being that women's rights organisations are very much squeezed between countering terrorism financing rules on the one side and terrorism acts on the other. And just to amplify that finding, 86.67% of surveyed organisations believe that their work in some way, generally upstream, like their work on peace building, their work on conflict resolution and rule of law development, had an impact on combating violent extremism and terrorism. So people felt they were, you know, on the ground having this impact. At the same time, 90% said, but actually counterterrorism measures are having an adverse impact on our ability to do our work on a daily basis. And so we have this extraordinary squeezing effect between groups that are seeking to address terrorism violence in their community and feeling like the government response to that is, rather than being helpful, is actually hindering the ability to do their work. I won't go through this in a huge amount of detail right now, but we do spend a lot of time in the report looking at what is it about women's rights organisations and women's rights organising that might make them particularly susceptible to feel adverse impacts of a risk-averse funding environment, of donors who are increasingly changing their grantee profile. And a couple of things that are worth mentioning, particularly this second last bullet point, which is, already the women's rights organisations with whom we were interacting and with whom we're familiar, we're often already operating in very insecure and repressive environments under threat from both terrorist actors and from governments, including often being labelled and criminalised as terrorist, right, by their own governments for their gender equality work. And that was creating a pretty vicious feedback loop where at the very time at which these groups were doing the most important work opposing repressive governments, they were being called terrorists and then being put outside the risk appetite of banks and of donors and of governments because they were very afraid that they may be accused of providing financial support to these groups. Particularly another feature that was very important as a final bullet point, that women's rights organisations, they work on very sensitive issues. So banks and donors seeking to do their due diligence from abroad, wouldn't necessarily find a public profile of the organisation that would fully match their activities. They would often look very slim. You couldn't Google and find the board of directors, for example, of small women's groups, and that made it really hard to think about, could they be funded in a way that would protect those donors from potential repercussions. And particularly with concerns about confidentiality of beneficiaries, which we can come back to a little bit too, is that the women's rights organisations with whom we spoke on would often be working on behalf of, for example, domestic violence victims, survivors of sexual assault, and not feel that they could provide that information to donors or to governments seeking to test whether or not they're a legitimate organisation. Okay, so what were the core impacts? And we'll go through these in much more detail, but just to kind of give the overall picture. Really, these rules on counterterrorism financing had been utilised to reduce the money available to these groups and to the operating space in which they conducted their activities. Number two, that it had changed the kinds of programmes you could do, where you could do them, with whom you could partner, and who you could serve, who your beneficiaries of your work could be. Number three, that there had been significant restrictions on access to financial services, so the ability to bank had been very much circumscribed by these rules. Number four, that these groups had experienced quite heavy due diligence and other administrative burdens. And finally, that these rules had created and amplified existing insecurity and had created an array of adaptive measures that women continue to resort to do their work that actually may have further endangered them. And again, we're going to go through this in much more detail, but sort of want to snapshot these here. Okay, so what do we mean by reduced resources and space? To give a snapshot of what that looks like, nearly 50% of organisations have reported that these rules, right, these counter-terrorism financing rules that are meant to stem money going to terrorism, had impacted their access to funds. So these are not groups that are intended to have the money cut off, through these rules, but in practice they've devolved to that effect. And these are organisations that are operating with both very low financial resilience and small income, but despite the need for much needed funds, these rules had also meant that 41.67% have actually not applied for certain grants due to the demands of counterterrorism financing. So due to the demands of having to vet partners, of having to vet beneficiaries, they simply chose not to apply for grants. And those are grants that are coming from, particularly from Western donors. Finally, and this is a sort of striking figure, that 16.67 said actually we were offered grants, but we ended up turning them down due to the strictures of counterterrorism financing, that we just can't on principle or in practice comply with the type of reporting and auditing requirements that were being imposed by these rules. And that could be, for example, that your donor requires you to vet every single person coming into your program, okay? Everyone in the hospital bed, in a particular location, or everyone in a refugee camp, but it simply wasn't tenable or principled necessarily as well. And there's a really strong feeling, and she was going to come through the quotes now, that actually these rules have not stopped money going to terrorism, they've stopped money coming to us, right? So the intention, has not been realised at all. And to give some examples, as the definition of who is a terrorist is often very vague, we are always in danger of being accused of supporting terrorism. With the rise of ISIS, this will become even more complex in our region. Okay. I think we need to address the governments and donors that terrorists have different ways than NGOs for operating. They limit our access to funds and our ability to work. I'll let people read the remainder. But again, these are rules that are meant to cut off money to terrorist organisations, actually cutting off money to those groups on the ground who are doing the work and are in danger in their daily efforts to address these groups. Okay. Programmatic partner and beneficiary impacts. Very quick observation is that essentially it was virtually impossible to be a women's rights organisation working in an area considered to be at risk of terrorism. Right? The fears of banks of sanctions, for example, the fears of donors of having repercussions, simply meant that rather than calibrating a risk-based approach to giving in those areas, they simply withdrew services. To work in Syria, to work in Iraq, to work in South Somalia, money has stopped going to those particular areas. What was very interesting too was really looking at, well, what additional impacts were women and girls experiencing as beneficiaries? As people who were trying to receive, the ultimate sort of outcomes of these grants and of this funding from abroad. In particular, what we saw is, if you're cutting off humanitarian assistance to an area under terrorist control, that made women and girls in that community dependent on that prescribed group for provision of services, right? Which was not a gender-friendly outcome, to put that in a very light way. We also saw a lot of reluctance or concern about donors and governments supporting victims of terrorism and violent extremism. Just have to think about that for a moment. These are victims of terrorism and violent extremism who we acknowledge, require support, psychosocial, medical, and so forth. But some donors and some governments are like, we're not entirely sure. Are they really victims? They could still actually be terrorist, individuals. We may be risking supporting them. And often they're still located in the at-risk areas, right? They're not geographically far away, and so there can be a concern around that. We also heard some concern about, can we support those who seek to disengage and reintegrate and be rehabilitated? Because again, are we really sure that they're not terrorists, right? And so, but technically, am I providing material support through these programs in ways that make me afoul of law? And so these are some very sort of perverse outcomes that were occurring. And finally, what we saw, and said it over to Isabel, is these rules and the auditing and the reporting and the checking and the vetting and all the concerns really have meant that donors expressed a preference for giving money to larger, well-known international organizations. It's easier, right? If you're in a situation where you're afraid of sanctions, you're afraid of reputational implications, then you're going to give that money to a large organization, primarily in the Western capital, you know, and pass that risk down the line. You know, it's not something you're going to take on. And so we saw a trend toward larger and fewer grants to large organizations. And because women's rights organizations are small, grassroots, often, you know, operating at the local level, that trend that sort of was, you know, sort of caused by CTF, by counter-trend filing, excuse me, really in practice excluded a range of organizations and activities from receiving much needed money.
So then I just have 5 minutes.
No, you have 10 minutes.
I'm going to multitask. So, okay. Mm-hmm. We're going to try. Some of the experiences that the women gave. Oh, God, I have to press mute. That they say, really, it's all of this is slowing us down. It's reducing funding, strains relationships between organizations, donors, partners, impacts the beneficiaries, as Jane was just sharing. If you are doing humanitarian work, can't send it to where it's needed, they're suffering, it limits creativity and flexibility, something that these organizations need to do their work, to come up with solutions, and they basically are saying donors, banks, and governments need to stop transferring the risks. Mm-hmm. Which is just going to move a little bit forward. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm just going to go to the impact on financial access. So basically what major impact that the groups were sharing is related to financial exclusion and different ways that their financial access is being hampered. And what we could see is the countering terrorism financing goal is in many cases overruling the goal of financial inclusion. Mm-hmm. And it's also really important that when you hear the term de-risking, many times it's framed as if it's merely about, you know, closure of accounts. But as we were talking to the groups, it was really clear that that was really a minor part of the problems that they're facing, and it manifests itself in multiple ways. So for example, 56% was saying our main problem is delays in or not receiving from donors. Now, why is that so important in terms of, you know, having a gender analysis? These groups don't have like big reserves. Mm-hmm. So they really get into trouble if like 1, 2, 3, sometimes up to a year, they have delay in funding. They just can't implement their programs. Sometimes they can't even keep their organizations going. Another important impact was a request for project information from banks before fund release. And this was really, I mean, from banks asking them, give us the donor contracts to really give us the project proposals. Mm-hmm. Tell us, who are you actually working with? To one person getting questions about her marriage certificate, mm-hmm. Where groups were really, really concerned about privacy issues about the groups that they are working with or the communities that they're serving. 50% was saying, well, there are government limits on transfers of funds. So, for example, that means you might get a grant of 100,000, but you can only have chunks every time, 5,000 or 10,000, which really slows also the project down on the ground. Mm-hmm. 30% refusal of banks to transfer cash to other countries. Again, many of these groups are also doing kind of networking activities, specifically in the region, so they can't move money around, which interferes with their movement building that they do. Request for information from security and intelligence agencies. Sometimes they say it's not very clear where the bank stop, government starts, and how intelligence community is linked to all that. Mm-hmm. 25% of refusal of banks to release funds altogether. Sometimes they were just going back to the donors. And 16% of refusal of banks to open bank accounts for the organization. Sometimes outright saying, you're not going to get it. But as some of the quotes will show, women's groups said, there's so many requirements, we can just not fulfill those. So it's more indirect that they're not able to open. And also they said, some donors make us open a new account for each project, which becomes a nightmare to manage. So the actual bank closure of accounts only occurred, you know, amongst 3.33% of the respondents. And actually, an interesting figure here is the Charity and Security Network in the U.S. just did a research on de-risking and how it impacts U.S.-based NGOs who work internationally. And that was a higher amount of organizations. There was 6.67% who was actually facing a closure of accounts. Many times in terms of de-risking, you know, it is very much related to the fact that these are smaller organizations, which for banks, specifically also banks far away, they are working in conflict areas. They're not very visible, as you're saying, so they seem to pose a higher risk. And we should not forget, banks have a lot of pressure on them to do the compliance checks, the due diligence checks. There's a lot of fines, you know, there's the fine threat that they have. They have to pay quite a big amount of money if they don't fulfill their obligations. So for them, you know, they become very risk averse, and this looks like a very, you know, risky and uninteresting group of customers. Sometimes people say in terms of recommendations, well, then women's groups should just go to the bank and start engaging in dialogue, which if you're in a conflict zone, you're very often, you know, not in a situation to do that, let alone if the bank, you know, we have correspondent banks, so very often the problem is in capital somewhere far away, so people can't go to Brussels, New York, or Geneva to talk to the banks and say, please, this is who I am, this is what I do. So basically, it's a big issue, but on the other hand, also, it can have a knock-on effect, because, for example, if you have problems with one bank, or you can't open your account, there are reputational risks, and it might be that other banks are also not very interested to take you on as a customer. So really, it's financial inclusion of the groups, but also we have to think about the impact this is having on the groups and the communities that they're serving. So I just want to share one quote here. Where the group in Pakistan is sharing, we're not able to open a new bank account anymore. It's not the bank that officially is refusing us, but they have made the process so heavy, so many regulations, verifications, documents, that it becomes totally impossible for us to comply with this. We can't fulfill it, and especially small organizations can't open accounts anymore. And also here in Libya, where people are saying government intelligence, banking system, it's interlinked, so it's very difficult to see where it's all actually coming from. So another major impact that we, and Jane also addressed it, that we found is the prohibitive costs of due diligence and other administrative burdens. So basically 85% of the survey respondents said, we are really experiencing an increased demand on our organizations, causing huge bureaucratic burden, administrative burden, and that is not only related to government or one actor, it's related to donors, which actually was a major agent where these compliance demands are coming from. It's coming from government, and it's also coming from the banks. So as we already mentioned before, that means that some of the organizations said we're not going to apply for certain funds anymore, we just can't fulfill those. We don't even meet the criteria in terms of donors, or we just don't want to because we lose the trust in our communities. Once they know that, they know what we have to give these donors in terms of information, they will just not trust us anymore. So we lose the support base that we have on the ground. Another one is also that the compliance means that you have to put a lot of hours into it, which means you need to have staff that can do that, which is, you know, not reflecting the reality of many women's groups who operate on the basis of volunteers or maybe 1, 2, 3 paid staff members. So they just can't handle that. Sometimes they have to hire legal help, which is quite expensive, which they don't have the money for, because they get project money, they don't get core funding, so they can't invest in building the capacity in the organization of their staff on how to learn how to deal with this. They also said it's causing an overload of work. During the research, we had a meeting in the Middle East where groups were really frustrated, saying, the kitchen is on fire, and we have to sit here, shuffle papers. So it's really, there's already so much insecurity, and there's so much workload we have, and it's frustrating that we can't focus on the people. We just have to sit here in our office and you know, do all this administrative work. People also mentioned that they could see the shift, as you mentioned, in terms of donors, that the donors are going for, you know, bigger organizations who can handle the due diligence. Some said that they still found donors who want to support them, but they used the don't ask, don't tell policy. So many times, you know, these organizations that get support would not get mentioned by the donor, which also impacts, you know, their visibility. Yeah? If your donor doesn't want to mention that they support you, you also can't go, you know, outside and say, I have this kind of support and I do this work. Then there's also the safety risk that organizations mention. If you do the compliance, you might be seen as a foreign agent, also by the community. Yeah. I'll go very fast. Okay, I'm just moving to the next one. So in terms of what is this leading to, and the fifth impact is insecurity and adaptive measures, 15% actually had faced harassment or prosecution under countering terrorism financing measures, which means their office would be raided, they were facing, you know, visits, for example, by intelligence officers, asking them to provide a lot of documentation. But 60% of the organizations actually said they have not come yet, but it's always in the back of our minds. We're really stressed out. We feel insecure. It's causing a lot of work for us. And I think we should not underestimate that many of these groups are already in highly insecure environments where, you know, every day that they go to work, they don't know what's going to happen to them, and they're very concerned about the people that they work for. So it's an extra level of stress that many said. It's the workload, but also the fact that it's difficult to maintain staff. High levels of burnout was one of the things that they mentioned. And some even said that there was quite high suicide rates within the organization. So it's being internalized by the activists. And also some feel like, you start also wondering about your professional capacity if suddenly, you know, there are all these demands and you feel like you're made to feel like you can't deliver. Women's groups are very, we all know that, very resilient, very creative. So what are they doing to deal with it for now? They're carrying cash around, quite a big number, use accounts of other organizations to still move the money. Other adaptive managers is they rename their projects, they don't do certain work anymore, they use Western Union, or they would simply register as a for-profit company, private sector, so they don't fall under the NGO legislation. They use foreign private bank accounts and use domestic accounts of family and friends. But again, and I will just leave it here, what happens with that is that women's groups are actually pushed into the shadow realm, where actually they're being made to look more shady because they use all kinds of strategies to survive. If you carry bags of money around in a conflict zone and somebody finds out, the government, or you know, it definitely is a reason that they will come after you. So it's not a long-term solution. It's not a sustainable solution, and it's therefore really something that needs to be addressed. So. We have recommendations, but if I go into those, I would take up more time.
You kindly provided some copies of the report, which are available in the phone if you're interested. And thank you so much for sharing your findings and insights about what it seems very bleak. And unfortunately, but it's great that these findings can be brought to the attention of the donors and understanding what's actually happening on the ground and the impacts, and hopefully it will lead to some change. Is there any, would you like to share some thoughts
with
us?
Sure. I'll be very brief because this is your show and I'm aware of the time. But for GAPS, as a platform in the UK working on women, peace and security, this report is so very much welcomed. And I thank you and all of your colleagues and your teams for all of your amazing hard work that went into this. It's such an incredible resource. And first off, I was just sort of struck and by how many of your findings and the trends that you identify sort of resonate within broader peace and security policy, and particularly the way governments and donors and other actors finance peace and security work, particularly picking up on the trends towards more restricted, short-term, but bigger grants that exclude so many of the vital actors that governments and donors providing that money acknowledge are really important for peace and security, women's rights work, gender equality, sustainable development, and so on. And in doing so, it's just very your the sort of impacts that you went through are you know incredibly stark. And you know, though we acknowledge we've come some way from the do no harm understanding, but it seems to me like this is contrary to what we believe do no harm to be, and it seems so far further back to our general approach to working in peace and security and taking this do no harm approach as international actors. So even more so, these findings are timely and really vital. And what is also amazing about your work is the level of detail it goes into in terms of the impacts on women's rights organisations. So a big part of what we do as GAPS and with our allies and so on is work to protect the space for civil society organisations all over the world, including for ourselves, to advocate on these issues, to implement programmes, to devise policy, to have a voice and to make sure it's heard. And we can talk in the sort of general term about the impacts on women's rights organisations, but to have this level of detail and this evidence from across the world and the spread that you've provided through your face-to-face interviews and research just really helps us to reiterate the advocacy asks that we have around what we want for women's rights organisations and movements and organising and human rights defenders, which amongst your many recommendations, the one that really stands out is the need for long-term, core, flexible funding. We and many of our allies have been asking for this for a very long time, and I think we've seen somewhat of a reverse. Like, we were starting to move there, and what's quite interesting is how much policy language still recognises the importance of this. So you pick up on the localisation agenda and the grand bargain. It's also related to the Sustainable Development Goals and the link between gender equality, stability, peace building, and so on, and the importance of local organisations and local buy-in and movements to achieving all of these things, therefore sort of begs the question as to, why donors and governments and so on continue to provide funding in such a way. Maybe it's because they didn't have this evidence, hopefully, maybe. Or what the other reasons, and maybe through your you could go into your discussions with donors to unravel some of that. But ultimately, just to say thank you very, very, very much. This would be an incredible resource to civil society worldwide, particularly for GAPS. And thank you for sharing your findings with us and coming here today.
Thank you. Okay, so let's and move on to questions. There's a roving mic. If you could wait for it, it would be great because the event is recorded. And I'll take a couple of questions in a row. I'm conscious of the time. We are supposed to finish at 7 p.m. because we have a reception to which you are all invited. So let's try to keep the time as much as we can. Leila. And please introduce yourselves before asking your question.
Hi, I'm Leila Eludat. I work at WILF. I have a question on most of the countries you mentioned have a displacement issue, whether from the countries or in neighboring countries. And our experience has been that displacement has a lot of impact on the ability to organize and work in neighboring countries that are the hosting countries. Has that been visible in your study? My question is, would there be recommendations for hosting states on finding more legal ways for organizations, for displaced communities, to be able to work legally to support the communities that they have been displaced from or the refugee community in hosting countries? Thank you.
Hi, I'm Geeta from Safer World. I'm wearing a previous hat also, coming from a humanitarian space previously, and I remember there was a previous discussion about, the work of putting up a hand pump and then who can use that hand pump and some of the similar discussions. Then I recall that there were some changes in the rules or policy or frameworks that kind of said that the kind of due diligence that NGOs can do is so much limited and not. So, I wonder if that actually did it have an impact on some of the findings that you found with the women's groups. And just adding to that, and maybe it's in your recommendations as well, what are women's groups then saying? And when I these are women-led organizations, are they talking about more clarity in definitions of who are these groups, you know, terrorist groups or risk cover, you know, like more clarity on definitions, because some of the courts are saying that they themselves have been, you know, they are also troubled with this extremism and they've been working with it even before this. Mm-hmm. So is that, so what is their ask actually in, so, yeah.
Lisa, and then over to you, and then we'll move.
I'm Lisa Gormley from the Centre for Women, Peace and Security here at LSE. I'd just love to know what your recommendations were. I know you didn't have time in your main presentation, but it would be, it's a big, tricky issue. I'd love to know what you propose as solution.
Yeah. And sorry, we have a question here.
Hi, I'm Kerry. I'm commercial paralegal. I'm just wondered what the, was it a problem with the definition about material support or the lack of, possibly, that is causing this? And is this a global or domestic, you know, is it a lack of precedent here? Or sort of what is causing that issue there?
Good question. And let's take the question as well.
Hi, I'm Inga Rolf, I'm one of the founders of GAPS and past chair of Womankind. I have a question around the origination of this and what analysis has been done, because it obviously was provoked, and we do know that there was a fair amount of funding that got channeled through NGOs. Has there been any analysis done on how much of that was actually through any women's organizations? Because I think that's quite material. And the second question is, and I'm sure this will come out and because we haven't heard the recommendations, but the possibility of creating some sort of clearinghouse that might be facilitating for the small organizations.
What an extraordinary set of questions.
I'm going to ask something difficult. I know it's very hard to keep it brief, but if you can, then maybe we can have another round of questions. So I would appreciate
it. Beautifully ambitious. Let's go. So on the question of, Leila, of women's groups that have been displaced, yes, that was a huge issue, particularly because often counterterrorism financing rules essentially in practice require organizations to be registered to be seen as a safe organization. But if you can't be registered in the country in which you're operating, suddenly, again, you're out of the risk appetite. So that's a bit, we heard a lot of that, like that I can't be registered, I'm not recognized, and therefore I'm outside. So there's a separate issue which I won't go into, but we do cover in the report also the issue of the gender impact of restrictions on remittances that occur to, so when women are trying to send money back to their sort of communities, these remittances are heavily regulated and cut off by these rules, and that has a gendered effect. So a quick answer on that. Yes, definition of material support is a huge issue here. So this is the challenge that both the idea of what constitutes support is, you know, very nebulous and very broad, and that governments in particular are reluctant to provide clarity around that for fear of incentivizing adverse behavior by organizations. And so any efforts to get governments to reform material support rules have not been very productive. And even frankly, even if you, sometimes what a government will do is point to the fact they don't actually prosecute material support that frequently, but that means little to the groups on the ground. As Isabel pointed out, the chilling effect, the rumor mill is so acute that actually, you know, it's the fear of this breadth of statute and laws that has an impact. On the how these rules came into effect, and it's also linked to the question on modified rules for NGOs, there was a very strong, particularly in the aftermath of 9/11, this strong sense that NGOs were particularly vulnerable. That was a language that was utilized to terrorism financing abuse. That characterization, since debunked, and only very recently, very much formed the sort of the core thread of a number of policies by governments and by financial institutions in this area too. It was only last, sort of two summers ago now, last summer, that the Financial Action Task Force in Paris, who has a recommendation number 8, which is about non-profit organizations, NPOs, actually removed that language that NPO just are particularly vulnerable. And that's massive, because exactly the, you know, what you had brought up is that, you know, there had been a feeling of trying to actually say that really are the NGOs the problem here, right? And should NGOs be subject to the same standards as financial institutions in doing due diligence? And the answer is no. And that's very clear in the FATF recommendation number 8 and its interpretive note. That language that clarifies that greatly. I have other things I'm going to stop and hand to you.
Yeah, I think maybe also related to the discussion we had during the day, that change to recommendation 8 didn't just come about, you know, like suddenly FATF decided we're going to change our recommendation 8 and the way we look at NGOs. It's really the result of engaged scholars, a lot of research on actually, okay, if they're extra vulnerable, show us the facts. Let's look at the evidence. And, you know, the research showed that it was not, it could not be backed up by that kind of evidence. So it was the combination of also research and advocacy by civil society, seeking the engagement with the FATF, which before was kind of a closed body. Nobody knew how it worked. And they kind of tried to figure out how it was working and started engaging. And now at least there's regular meetings. I think one of the main recommendations that we have is make sure that women's groups are also at the table. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise the solutions that are going to be developed will fit certain sectors of civil society, but still doesn't take, and that's actually one of the reasons we did this, like it needs to fit the reality and the challenges that women's groups are facing. I think in terms of what the women said, you know, as we were going through the questions, in terms of definitions, many of them, they had excellent analysis of power, and they, well, they were really describing how definitions are just all the time changed to kind of hit those who dissent. I mean, that fits the whole shrinking space discussion that we all know. So they say those in power can be very creative with definitions, so they can still, you know, hit you. So it was not so much that they wanted. They wanted to know more about how this works. So they had seen the reality change. They've seen banks behave in a certain way, they've seen donors change, but they don't know what is driving it. So for them it was a question of knowledge, capacity building, networking. They wanted to, you know, come together with other women's groups and analyze, you know, what's happening to them, but also to build a coalition and engage in advocacy and any other forms of influencing this. Because what is very clear is on your own in a country trying to change whoever this, you know, is responsible for this, it's you stick out your neck and you're very vulnerable. So you need to be, you know, in a larger community of people who are really working on this issue. Gonna try to do 2 minutes of recommendations. If I find my paper, I might have to do that. Okay, for the multilateral institutions, it's really about pointing out how it's the need for having an inclusive banking system, and the multilateral institutions can provide guidance and support to countries and financial institutions on making the financial sector and the banking system more inclusive, including in terms of gender inclusivity. And also one key recommendation was to make sure that there's always gender and human rights expertise on CT entities, to really always show on what is the human rights impact of the policies that you design. For states, it's really, I mean, all of the states are coming up with counterterrorism financing regulations, so it's really important that, you know, they have a check on whether these are compliant with human rights and humanitarian law, specifically the principle of non-discrimination and equality. And key is, for example, when we talk about the FATF, they regularly have evaluation rounds. So it means that the country is rated for how are you complying with the FATF regulations, which are many more than R8. So in that sense, it's important there's engagement with civil society. And the FATF evaluators are looking into that. But in that evaluation, make sure that women's civil society is included, including the grassroots. And we would say it's broad. Gender also means LGBTQI community, so that they can share how it's impacting them. In terms of civil society, we need to conduct the evidence-based, I'm sorry, but that's the way it worked, you know, the research So it can inform our awareness raising, it can inform our advocacy. We have to do that with states, multilateral institutions, donors, financial institutions, but also the public. So it's also really important. There's the whole social corporate responsibility. Also within the banking sector, I think it's important to, you know, engage with the public and look at how this is working out and impacting civil society. In terms of donors, important that donors also invest in feminist research so we can do the data gathering, bringing groups together so they can not just only network, learn from each other, but also come up with advocacy strategies so they can continue to be present in these places and, you know, point out how their space is shrinking, but also what can be done about it. And lastly, in terms of financial institutions, what is really lacking right now is continuous and regular interaction between, on the one hand, government, civil society, and the financial sector on what is happening, how is this impacting civil society, and how can things be done in a way that civil society can still operate and do its very much needed gender, peace, and security work. Mm-hmm. And we've also had a recommendation that it would be good if the financial sector would track the patterns in the de-risking, start really documenting what are the reasons that they are closing accounts or not onboarding clients or why there are delays. So that was the one thing mm-hmm. that, specifically when you did the interviews, it was really difficult. They don't have data. They don't keep track of how often and with whom. So that makes it very difficult from that end to mm-hmm. start coming up with a more targeted, more, I would say human rights and gender inclusive practice.
I think and I'm going to add one thing on that too, for the recommendations, is to, in this space, recognize that there are actually areas in which interests overlap. You know, so for example, financial institutions, by and large, are not happy that they have become essentially deputized to enforce government rules on counterterrorism financing. That they incur high compliance costs, they have huge reputational and other risks of sanctions, and they also know they've reached a tipping point where they're debanking legitimate customers. There's a recognition of that, and so I think it's important, particularly, and it's not a normal, necessarily normal ally in our space in working on the promotion of gender and human rights, but to really think about where these areas overlap. And I think that's one example of exactly, encouraging these entities to track, and to engage is a fruitful recommendation that maybe would not normally make in other circumstances.
Great, thank you. Any questions? We can take one question in the last 2 minutes, or maybe two. Or we can just go to the reception.
Free. Okay. And they're all in a row.
Thanks. Hi. Is that on? Helen Pelson from the FCO. I just wanted to ask a question about how you distinguish or whether you analysed the extent to which the sort of regulations were kind of legitimate. Sorry, that's a very kind of... That's the wrong word, but... So I'm thinking of the example of Egypt, so where the restrictions on civil society have come through an NGO law, which may, if you dig far enough beneath it, be about CT financing, but is also explicitly about controlling foreign funding. And therefore, as kind of potential funding organisations, we have absolutely no sort of control. And in fact, it has prevented us from supporting partners that we'd want to. So, any kind of thoughts on that?
Sorry, it's really a very practical question. I was just wondering if you have published this in academic output yet, because feminist economics so needs to see this. And I think it would just be really fascinating to be in dialogue. I'm sure you are already in dialogue with... It's just... I'm not sure who's present here, but considering we're London School of Economics and... political science, I'm not sure if we have people from the economics department in the room. No, I don't think we do, but it's a little bit of an indication of, I'm not going to slag off my own institution, but a little bit of an indication of, actually, we have a feminist economics course that we offer, and they're really interested in financialization issues and doing gender analysis. So I guess I was just wondering if, if there's a intention to sort of publish it and engage with other sort of audiences.
There's one more question there.
Hi, I have a very just quick comment, and it's my name's Cleo, I'm from the Tony Blair Institute, and just a comment really on behalf of some of the grassroots organisations that we work with and talk to, particularly in Southern Sahara and Africa. And it's about the fact that, and I was pleased that you mentioned the point about the discordance with inclusive policies that talk about engaging grassroots but then physically stop it from happening. And I think I get the sense that there's also a research fatigue amongst a lot of organisations who feel kind of used a lot by multilateral organisations and governments who want access to the networks, want to use them as a gateway, want to kind of do these, I guess, conflict holiday tours where they go and talk to all these women, but then they don't feel that they get offered anything from it at the end. So that's just another impact that I'm sure you have, that came up in your work.
So I'll take the first question. So it absolutely, we document examples of where the counterterrorism financing regime is utilized to provide cover for illegitimate control of civil society. Yeah, that is clear. And you know, it's the challenge, right? Because these are rules, because they are so broad, because they have such extraordinary implications, it can somehow seem to sanitize or sanction local action. And I think that's particularly where thinking more, as Isabel mentioned, about utilizing, you know, when FATF does an evaluation of a country's compliance with its recommendations, including on CTF, like to incorporate within there, actually, are you overreaching with these rules in a way that is illegitimate? And the answer would be yes in many contexts. And that also goes to the point of then including diverse civil society actors in that space to be able to comment on the ways in which these impacts are being felt. So we definitely saw both deliberate use of the cover of a CTF multilateral or bilateral requirement, and other examples, frankly, where it wasn't deliberate, but again, the incentives to engage in risk-averse behaviour, which is so huge, that in practice it meant that people had stopped doing the kind of grant giving that you should give. And so, and definitely also, as you mentioned, rules on restricting foreign funding of NGOs, CTF provides a really nice cover for that, because it regulates transnational financial flows. So those two go together, so absolutely. And it was really hard to sort of disentangle the different pieces, but we try and do that in the report. On the issue, and I really appreciate you bringing this up, particularly thinking about different, both different modalities of sharing the research, also different fora in which it should be shared, and particularly, you know, really thinking about how do we ensure that folks who work on sort of from this from an economist perspective, you know, from a political science perspective, engage? And I think this has been, you know, definitely a challenge, as it has been an area that both those working on sort of more the gender and human rights side of the equation have stayed away from analysing, primarily because it's so incredibly technical, and you know, to be able to sort of gain access to the range of sort of institutions, both bilaterally, multilaterally, and so forth, and to frankly be able to do the research that WPP did, which is, you know, to go and talk to these organisations and to have that trust, you know, where people will share that information, because this has huge implications for their reputational safety and their safety and their funding. And so I think there has been a lot of siloing and not enough yet of an effort to have different people coming at some different issues being engaged. And I want to one thing to hand over is we didn't address your question on the clearinghouse recommendation. And I think this is exactly where we need to have different groups come together to really talk through do potential solutions fit every actor? And just to give one example on this, you know, one thing that got sort of thrown around by the larger humanitarian groups working in this space was like, well, what about having a solution where you have a whitelist of NGOs, right? It's not a blacklist, a whitelist of sort of pre-approved organisations that banks can look at, that donors can look at, that governments can look at. Now, as gender hat, you know, sort of begin screaming at that suggestion, not in a positive way, right? Which is, no, because that's going to, again, reinforce a preference for large, safe, well-known organisations that do not challenge status quo. But if you don't have this voice and this perspective in those conversations, that sounds, for a government and for a bank, that sounds nice. That sounds easy, right? That sounds like a good idea. And so I think part of, you know, what I took from your question is we need to constantly complicate who's in conversation with each other on these issues and to make sure that solutions really, it's not quite a clearinghouse, which actually people are talking about, and we can talk more about sort of offline, but these kind of other things get thrown up sometimes that we instinctively can know are not good solutions, but if you're not at the table, they proceed.
Yeah, I think in terms of the last question about fatigue with the international community, it's something we discussed earlier today, but it was really something that did come up during the interviews, that there was quite some frustration on how they felt that these trends are impacting them, but they also felt there was not the solidarity they needed from other civil society organizations, that it seemed that for some it proved to be an opportunity because they could, you know, deliver the compliance. So several of the women's groups really said, on the one hand, like, bigger groups are coming to do the work, or they still find us, but they subcontract us. Many of the groups are feeling very committed to their communities, and they say it interferes with the way we do our bottom-up movement building. So it's not just about civil society NGO work. A lot of it is about civil society social mobilizing movement building, where they were saying we're just needed, forced to fit a box, and that box is even making us irrelevant to our community. So at the end, we even lose the support we need from our communities to do our very challenging work, because they do challenging work. And if you don't have people around you that support you, you stand completely alone. I think in terms of the research, there is also, of course, research fatigue. I fell on this issue. I was amazed, sometimes also very emotional, about what people were actually sharing. I think people were extremely brave. And I think it was because they all know the Women, Peace and Security agenda very well. They don't need more research, particularly on how to empower women. And for them, it was really the shrinking space. They see something is changing. They see it's not delivering. And it's impacting them. It's also impacting other sectors of civil society and social mobilizing. So they're worried about that. So something that helps them understand and I think create a community, a global community of support. We were very clear about this. This needs to show the global dimension, because this is not just about women only in the MENA region or in certain parts of Asia. This was also American groups. This was Western groups, Western European groups. So it's a global phenomenon that also provides an opportunity for global action in a way that better be in solidarity and not in competition, because I think that's also, you know, a reality that is there and that we need to talk about and address.
Thank you very much. It was fascinating. I wish we had more time to hear from you, but as I said, thank you for bringing us your copies of your report, so please feel free to take. Before we finalize, we have a lot going on at the center. We have a lot of events planned for this term. The next one is on the 18th of May at 5 p.m. Professor Catherine McKinnon will be discussing her new book, Butterfly Politics. And for more center activities, please check our Facebook, Twitter, and website. And please join me in thanking our fantastic, wonderful speakers and our discussants for sharing their